You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast, number 102.
Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. That was a teaser from Parsley Sage, Rosemary and Thyme by Jane Auberg. She's a solo electric violinist using digital effects, and she's from Australia. So I think you'll like it. I'm sure the tune is familiar to you, and she has a unique way of bringing it to life. So we'll play the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. As always, I'm going to post the links to all of the websites we discuss on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. So let's move on to my main topic today, the iPad in education. Today I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Mary Ann Gowalik. She's the provost of Seton Hill University, not Seton Hall, Seton Hill University. And this is actually a follow-up to the interview with Dr. Gowalik that I did back in September 2010, just as they were about to launch their trend-setting iPad program. So during the interview, we're going to try to answer some of the questions. Why did they provide both iPads and MacBook Pros to their students? Did they flip their classrooms? How is the faculty adjusting to the new paradigm? Have they saved on printing costs? Do they recommend certain apps? How about iBook Author and other e-textbook programs? Is it important for iPads to be integrated with the LMS? What lessons did they learn? And what did they change, if anything, during their second iPad deployment this past fall? And last but not least, how do they gauge the success of the iPad program? So without further ado, here's the interview with Mary Ann. Mary Ann, thanks for agreeing to speak with me today. It's been about, I think, 18 months or so since we last talked, and very anxious to hear about your experience since September 2010 with your iPads on campus. So for those in my audience who don't know what Seton Hill was doing, maybe you can give a brief summary of how this all started, and then I'll follow up with some questions.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Ronnie. Seton Hill, a couple days after Steve Jobs announced the iPad, decided that we would take a leap into the future and get that the iPad device to help us have 24/7 access to information and presentation tools for all students and faculty. We are a teaching university with about 2,400 students overall. So got the iPads to all full-time students, to all faculty, many support staff, and got iPads and MacBooks to entering freshmen. And now at this point, when we're starting this fall, we will have achieved 3 years of all students having the MacBooks and the iPads. And I can talk a little bit about that combination because it's a little interesting to think about.
In our plans here at the University of the Sciences, we're going to do a couple trials and a couple programs with just the iPad. So, yeah, I'm interested in your rationale for providing both to your students.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what early we just got back another year of data. This is what we continue to see. If students only have the iPads, they more fully use the iPads for intaking information, examining information, downloading educational resources, and what I would call small time production. If they have the MacBooks and the iPad, 90% of the iPad use is for reading, evaluating, getting information, and production is almost done fully on the MacBook. And I think it's actually interesting. Some of it, I think, is simply style. Some of it's keyboard accessibility. Although I wanted to actually see what would happen, and I made sure about five or six of our faculty had keyboards as cases with their iPad to see if that would increase iPad use and decrease production use on the MacBooks. We still see people go back and forth. It's actually interesting when you talk to the students and the faculty, because I actually, when I do classroom observations and see the students' use, it is not unusual to see a student have a MacBook, their iPad set up, and their phones, which given time, they're using all three devices, which is interesting to me.
Yeah, they say they're multitasking. Sometimes when my daughter tells me that, I'm not so sure.
Well, I think actually, oftentimes when I see this in class, students have different, so on their iPads, they might be pulling up some materials that they presented for the class. On their computers, they might be taking notes. And there's no question, if their phones come out, 90% of the time they're texting. And so you kind of have to observe that. I'm increasingly watching faculty who kind of do some, you know, 15 minutes into class, give a 1 minute break for people if they need to do text contact with people so that it's not distracting while the classroom is going on. When you do classroom observations on this, if, and again, this we would always say this, right? If the instructor is a good instructor, the students are using the devices for why we got them for them. They're looking up information, they're calling out answers, they're using creation and creativity tools to kind of get to something. But in the same way, if an instructor is a little bit more tentative and or a little bit less savvy, you begin to see some students drift off to Facebook and playing solitaire.
Right. You know, that brings up one of my questions is, have you seen then a change in the use of the so-called lecture time? I'm assuming like a lot of schools, it was basically lecture, and now it sounds like you've flipped the classroom, as they say, and do more activities in class. Is that what's been happening?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. I think we were probably a little bit more activity engaged even before we had the technology, but there is no question. You see more experiential, applied classroom activities with the expectation students had read or listened more in advance. I think our faculty are just beginning to move to what I would call the formally flipped classroom. Now, I think for people who have content dense classes, it's still difficult to believe that the student can hear that on a podcast from the instructor, or that they can get open resource educational materials and have a lecturer, a main lecturer from, I don't know, some university and download it and that their students will get it. That's a struggle to really encourage faculty to use all those open source materials. So I would say we're almost flipped.
Do you have a means for faculty to create video capture kind of resources for them to view, on their own time?
Yeah, we're just moving up to a lecture capture system. We wanted to make sure people really wanted to do it before we invested in it. So there's a group of about 15, 20 faculty who will do a major pilot with it this year. I mean, I want to really encourage people to do that as well as use these open educational resources. I think for a small liberal arts school, that actually opens a window of educational opportunity for students that we didn't have 3 years ago.
It seems like every day there are new applications and you hear about new apps and so forth. Are there any apps first of all, do you prescribe certain apps to be loaded on all the students' machines? And I guess the second part of the question is, have you identified some new apps, with your 2 years of experience now that you think are really top notch?
We do not prescribe apps. Both the faculty and the students identify, find, use a large number. But we really leave that up to the instructor's choice in the same way that I leave it up to the instructor to decide what educational resources they want. Truth be told, there's a lot of creativity apps that people use. So they use Quirkless, kind of Poplet, those kind of things. And our writing faculty use that. Our family and consumer science people do apps that allow people to track budgeting and loan development. Everybody is downloading resource material. So you start seeing that. And, we had one of our computer science majors created an app so that our residence life people could report incidents and keep track of room usage in the residence halls. I mean, so people are using different things.
Have you identified any textbook programs that you use? Are you waiting for the iBook author to catch on? Is that something that you're looking at?
We already began some training for faculty on the iBook author to look and see if it was something that people wanted to embrace. A number of faculty have continued to use textbook options from Inkling, which is a highly interactive textbook. And we're beginning to see, people go to their favorite companies, and you're beginning to see across kind of the standard textbook publishers, you're beginning to see either the flat PDFs, which from my vantage point doesn't really help what we're trying to do, or much more multimedia text. Bill Camarni, our chief information officer, is involved in some interesting work collaborating with some colleagues related to Pearson's to kind of really see, could we jump over and use highly interactive educational materials and get rid of what we used to call as the textbook?
Yeah, in terms of textbooks and printing out the old, course handouts, I imagine this has an impact on your printing budget. I know that's what I've seen some other schools. They save money on their printing budget. How about your students, though? Are they satisfied with reading on the iPad, or do you have a feel for, how many students still decide they want to print everything out?
Well, it's actually interesting. I do not have hard data on this, but what I know is that we cut our printing budget by about a quarter in this past year. So, and I will kind of use one class example. So I did a class of 24 students in January. I printed nothing, and the students submitted nothing in paper. And so when I look around, we don't have the data from this year, but it is one of the questions we ask the faculty. And what we're hoping to be able to do is, if that decreased use of paper continues, is decrease the technology fee a little bit, because part of what that fee was to pay for their printing costs. And I think some students still print. Like, we have one program that I will not identify who really literally says to the students, there's a printer right next to them, oh, go get your notes and print them out. And I mean, it just drives me crazy, but if the faculty believe by discipline that that's important, that's not an argument we're going to take on.
How important is it, do you think, that the iPad and your apps are integrated with your LMS? Is there any integration there, or you view them as sort of, totally separate realms?
You can certainly read, get to our LMS from the iPad. Phil did the code to make sure, and the IT people did that. We actually have probably about a third of our faculty are testing and probably certainly using Moodle. And again, that's actually been another adjustment to the iPad, because you have to kind of do some tinkering to make it usable. It seems important because the students have to be able to get to their materials that way. So when we run into any glitches, everybody gets cranky. You guys are using Blackboard, is that what you said?
Yes. In fact, we're quite excited about Blackboard. We started sort of in pilot mode. About 25% of our students were on it since the fall. One of our colleges, basically, Mays College of Healthcare Business and Policy. And we were rolling it out to everybody this coming fall. So we're excited about the integration, because Blackboard Mobile Learn puts an iPad friendly, touch friendly face on the Blackboard LMS. So it really makes it seamless working with the iPad.
Mm-hmm. I can say that, certainly students can get to our LMS and use it easily on the iPad screen. I think if I were going to make a prediction in 5 years, the whole question of how we use LMSs may be dramatically different if we keep expanding what we're doing with the textbooks. So those two may end up being merged functions in a way we haven't thought about. And when I'm really saying merge, not moving all the materials into an LMS, but the understanding of how those function, I think, will shift.
How have your faculty adjusted to this whole new paradigm of teaching? Are there still some holdouts, or is everybody on the bandwagon?
It's actually interesting. So we just finished this year. We now have about 66 people who went through the the full professional development training. So think about the time of the amount of time you would commit to a 3-credit course. And 2/3 of that group kind of have done a course revision and presented that course revision. I think faculty in general find it incredibly helpful to their teaching. However, there is no question, the more ramped up the faculty get in terms of using the tools with their full capacity, it does increase workload for classes. And so we have been very mindful to talk about that long term. So if you're working on a course and you, in the process of this training, revamp one course and then you revamp a second course, integrating a lot of what you're using, the technology allows you to simply both expand and deepen what you're teaching, and so it's taking more time. And the faculty here love to teach, and we're a teaching institution, so there hasn't been grave complaints about that. But boy, it makes, quite honestly, as the person responsible administratively, I'm always watching that to understand it and be mindful of it. And I think if we really stay in this generative application to learning mode, that will continue to keep faculty redesigning and playing, and you know, just looking for apps takes a lot of time.
I had a question about, you know, what lessons you learned going from your first experience with iPads in September 2010, and you know, what did you learn and what did you change when you had your second deployment?
Mm-hmm. In the second year of deployment, I think we were just more ready to literally hand out the box and have people sign them on the iPads. We even gave less instruction than we did the year before, simply because the students get the device and start playing with it pretty rapidly. So I think we were mindful of that. I am not going to be able to describe this technologically, but they began, our IT people, pretty carefully monitor our network to make sure that they are shifting wireless capabilities if we have a large group of users. So we do a summer reading program. So at the start of the year, we have 500 people in an auditorium discussing the book, and all of them were going for resource materials in the conversation. And so they had to do whatever IT does to make sure wireless didn't go down at all. I think faculty are more readily putting the requirement to buy apps onto the syllabus. So students know if they have to spend $9 like they would have to spend to buy a book, so that the students are prepared to do that. I actually think our students have developed a willingness to say to a faculty member now, what you're trying to do is a little crazy. I mean, I think the students are more willing to give feedback about ineffective use of technology. And I think everybody kind of sees that as part of the learning community.
Yeah, it seems like there's more of a dialogue, a conversation,
right,
which is good.
Right, absolutely. I think if I were going to say the biggest achievement is we continue to remind people that the devices should be used when they are appropriate in the classroom. And sometimes you say to yourself and to the students you're working with, let's turn them off for a while, let's take a break, and let's kind of use something else. Now, I would bet that the average faculty member doesn't do that, but in some course situations, it's appropriate to do it.
How do you measure the success of a program like this?
Well, it's actually been interesting, and as you might suspect, it is a big challenge. So what the feedback for 2 years, we've done surveys and some focus group with students and faculty and asked for feedback. That feedback has told us literally the same thing 2 years in a row, which is both learners and faculty believe that it opens communication, has increased successfully for a positive purpose, access to information, opened up the walls of the classroom. So I think everybody's getting this concept that there's more accessibility peer-to-peer, peer-to-faculty, faculty among themselves if they're keeping multiple sections. So that's been successful, and people feel like it's better communication and it's quicker communication. I think the students believe it that in the experiential part, the application part of their learning, the devices help and the faculty are being effective using that. We seem to have by faculty report, overall more student participation in classes. We have had better retention, but I have no idea if it's correlational.
We're looking at some so-called back-channel applications that would, even during class time, give students an opportunity to, ask questions and collaborate on questions and give more immediate feedback during the class.
Well, it's actually interesting. I cannot do this. I do not have the capacity to jump back and forth, but there are whole groups of faculty who do back channeling so that students can ask questions as they're lecturing. I actually can't do it. It kind of throws me off a little bit. But they do that. And the thing that I love is in our faculty senate meeting, there's a people back channel and there's a moderator who will throw out questions that have risen thematically from four or five people to make sure people who are quieter or less dominating have an opportunity to raise challenges.
Yep, it's perfect use of the technology. Is there anything else you want to say about the future with this program? Or are there any other changes you plan to make next fall?
I think next fall we're set to go the way we are. Although, the new students will bump up to an iPad 3 and high-end users will end up getting iPad 3s. I'm not quite sure it's going to have the same difference as moving from 1 to 2, which having the camera made a big, big difference. I think what we're really looking at very carefully with student use is, do they need the MacBook and the iPad? I think for us, that's a question that we keep on looking at. And I'll be interested hearing your feedback from you all, kind of who use more predominantly the iPad, whether or not you feel like that's enough.
Yeah, it's interesting. We haven't decided to go the route of, giving them a laptop. A lot of students already have them. We've said that it's not supposed to be a replacement. It's not supposed to be necessarily their primary production device, as you mentioned. But if you look at what Apple was saying in the beginning, they also said, oh, this is just a, initially they said it was a consumption device for media. But now there's some quite incredible apps on there that you can do original, development. The typing is an issue. Certainly sometimes when I travel with mine, I might take a Bluetooth keyboard, but I don't want to carry that around all the time. And I've seen people, though, that can type on the screen keyboard amazingly well. I'm not quite there. But just as an aside, there's a Kickstarter project that developed a silicone overlay to the iPad that has buttons on it. And it actually works by touching the on-screen buttons, but it gives you tactile feedback. So I'm waiting to get that. That should be coming shortly, and I'm anxious to try that as a keyboard aid. I'll let you know how that goes.
I was going to say, I'd like that feedback. While I love the waving and the touch of the iPad, there is a moment that you really also want that tactile sense of, oh, I'm hitting an H.
Well, Marianne, thank you so much. It sounds like you've had a very successful, rewarding program using the iPads. You're a trailblazer and continued success.
Okay, thank you, and you have a great day.
All right, you too. Take care now. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Don't forget to check the links on my show notes at rodspulsepodcast.com and stay tuned for Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. Until next time, have a great week.
that's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog, send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com, or leave audio feedback on his comment line at 610-616-2199. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.